somebody else's work like this, but I just think in some cases it's worth it. And it's called Complex Systems Won't Survive the Competence Crisis. And what he's going to get into, it's a long article. I'm not going to go all the way through it. I just want to get on, hit some of the big beats here. But I would advise everybody to read this because it's really quite the eye opener. And what he's going to get into is the implications of diversity hiring. Now he focuses on America, but this is coming in everywhere now across the West where we see it. And how did this come about? Well, what are the consequences of this happening? And we can see that he begins the article by pointing out that at a casual glance, the recent cascades of American disasters might seem unrelated. So, we've got this tendency to think that this is it's just about political correctness and it's about being woke and it doesn't really have that many consequences. He's gonna break us out of that spell. This is really like an emergency wake-up call of an article. I think it's important to point out as well that he isn't a sort of white supremacist or something like that. He's interested in it. He's looking at it from a purely meritocratic point of view, and how it's affecting these complex systems. He sees America as a massive, a giant web of complex systems operating within other complex systems, and each of them you've got these millions of nodes, and they all have to be functioning as good as they can. Otherwise, you're going to get disasters, like quite literally. And he says, in a span of a fewer than 6 months in 2017, three U.S. naval ships experienced three separate collisions, resulting in 17 deaths. A year later, power lines owned by PG&E started a wildfire that killed 85 people. The pipeline carrying almost half of the East Coast gasoline shut down due to a ransomware attack. Almost 500,000 intermodal containers sat on cargo ships unable to dock at Los Angeles ports. A train carrying thousands of tons of hazardous and flammable chemicals derailed near East Palestine, Ohio. Air traffic control cleared a FedEx plane to land on a runway occupied by a Southwest plane preparing to take off. Eye drops contaminated with antibiotic-resistant bacteria killed four and blinded 14. While disasters like these are often front-page news, the broader connection between the disasters barely elicits any mention. America must be understood as a system of interwoven systems. The healthcare system sends a bill to a patient using the postal system, and that patient uses the mobile phone system to pay the bill with a credit card issued by the banking system. All these systems must be assumed to work for anyone to make even simple decisions. But the failure of one system has cascading consequences for all of the adjacent systems. As a consequence of escalating rates of failure, America's complex systems are slowly collapsing. The core issue that is changing political mores have established the systemic promotion of the unqualified and sidelining of the competent. So once again, he's not looking at this in purely racial terms. He's looking at it in terms that it's kind of refreshingly objective and analytic. He's basically saying the system, America is a system, a very, very, probably the most complex system that's ever existed in the history of the world. And you need, as he would put it, your peak top social capital, who are there on merit, keeping all of these systems ticking over. And as he's going to get into here, that's not what's happening at all. In fact, it's the opposite. So at its inception, it represented a break from the trend of the 1920s to the 1960s, when the direct meritocratic evaluation of competence became the norm across vast swathes of American society. In the first decades of the 20th century, the idea that individuals should be systemically evaluated and based on their ability rather than wealth, class, or political connections led to significant changes in selection techniques at all levels of American society. The Scholastic Aptitude Test, the SAT, revolutionized college admissions by allowing elite universities to find and recruit talented students from beyond the boarding schools of New England. So he's already saying, really, you know, the old, more traditional order, which was more nepotistic, that was sort of that was brushed aside in the 19 after World War II, basically, and you got this purely meritocratic people where the people from all over the country were funneled into the universities based only on merit and nothing else. This is, of course, completely gone now. So by the 1960s, I've just skipped a forward here. By the 1960s, the systemic selection for competence came into direct conflict with the political imperatives of the civil rights movement. During the period from 1961 to 1972, a series of Supreme Court rulings, executive orders and laws, most critically the Civil Rights Act of 1964, put meritocracy and the new political imperative of protected group diversity on a collision course. So just to point out the obvious here, this is not something which has just come in the last few years, in America at least. That goes all the way back, well, it's like nearly 60 years, to be honest. But it takes a long time for this to wriggle its way through and the implications of it all to be felt. Administrative law judges have accepted statistically observable disparities in outcomes between groups as prima facie evidence of illegal discrimination. The result has been clear. Anytime meritocracy and diversity come into direct conflict, diversity must take priority. So you see, the problem here is that the administrative law judges have accepted statistically observable disparities in outcomes between groups as evidence of illegal discrimination. So the issue is the founding premise of this is that everybody is the same. Everybody is equal, of course. You see the sort of lefty, sort of Marxoid crocodile sticking its head above the water there. So that the outcomes then, the different groups should have the same outcomes. And if that is not the case, then somebody has to explain why it's not happening. And they're going to say it's structural problems, it's white supremacy, it's racism. So then they need to further entrench into law policies which result in fairer outcomes. But it's if because of the founding premise is flawed, in my view, they can never get there. And what they're going to do is pretty much destroy this Western civilization in the attempt to try. The resulting norms have steadily eroded institutional competency, causing America's complex systems to fail with increasing regularity. In the language of a systems theorist, by decreasing the competency of the actors within the system, formerly stable systems have begun to experience normal accidents at a rate that is faster than the system can adapt. The prognosis is harsh but clear. Either selection for competence will return, or America will experience devolution to more primitive forms of civilization and loss of geopolitical power. So, in a way, you see that the political Civil Rights Act, the political correctness, and the obsession with multiculturalism more generally, diversity, is actually at odds with America as a superpower. America is safe. America is never going to be invaded. It's almost impossible for even a coalition of nations to hit America. And even in terms of being blockaded or whatnot, the Americans will be fine. They've got this gigantic landmass. They can prepare their own food. So in a way, America is like perfectly situated to be a superpower for forever, for hundreds and hundreds of years. But what's actually happening is that they're sabotaging their social capital, the social capital which is actually responsible for running the most complex system of all time. And here from meritocracy to diversity, then the first domino to fall as civil rights era policies took effect was the quantitative evaluation of competency by employers using straightforward cognitive batteries. While some tests are still legally used in hiring today, several high-profile enforcement actions against employers caused a wholesale change in the tools customarily usable by employers to screen for ability. After the 1970s, employers responded by shifting from directly testing for the ability to using the next best thing, a degree from a highly selective university. By pushing the selection challenge to the college admissions officers, selective employers did two things. They reduced their risk of lawsuits and they turned the US college application process into a high-stakes war of all against all. Admission to Harvard would be a golden ticket to join the professional managerial class, while mere admission to a state school could mean a struggle to remain in the middle class. This outsourcing did not stave off the ideological change for long. Within the system of political imperatives now dominant in all major US organizations, diversity must be prioritized, even if there is a price in competency. So, you know, like one of the things we talk about with the woke capital in particular, and the go woke, go broke thing, which hardly ever seems to actually materialize, there's actually a more serious problem, and it's that just basic competency to keep these complex systems running. Later on, he's going to get into that in more detail. The definition of he's kind of objective here, but you know if you're a white man, you're just being purged from institutions, which he's going to detail here. The definition of diversity varies by industry and geography. In elite universities, diversity means Black, Indigenous, or Hispanic. In California, Indian women are diverse, but Indian men are not. When selecting corporate board members, diversity means anyone who is not a straight white man. The legally protected and politically enforced nature of this imperative renders an open dialogue nearly impossible. Because, and I think this is where you're really going to get into some pessimism, black pills here. The problem is, in order to undo this, you're going to have to undo the ratchet of left-wing dogma. And when you try to do that, they're going to call you a white supremacist. They're going to say that you're far right. The only reason that you want to undo these laws is because you're a racist. And so because you can't question the foundations of the blank slate. And so all of this is locked in. It's locked in law and legislation and policy. So, and to undo it would be seen as some sort of far-right revolution, whereas if it stays the same, the complex system which is America, is going to collapse slowly but surely, bit by bit. It isn't that you're going to get this big collapse coming in. He'll do that. He'll explain that better than I can. However, diversity itself is defined. Most policy on the matter is based on a simple premise. Since all groups are identical in talent, any unbiased process must produce the same group proportions as the general population, and therefore, processes that produce disproportionate outcomes must be biased. So there it is, and it's written right into law. Unlike accounting policies, which emanate from the financial accounting standards boards and are then implemented by chief financial officers, the diversity punch emanates inside of organizations from multiple power centers, each of which joins in for independent reasons. CEOs push diversity policies primarily to please board members and increase their status. Human resources professionals push diversity policies primarily to avoid anti-discrimination lawsuits or because everybody's terrified of the law. Business development teams push diversity to win additional business from diversity-sensitive clients, e.g. government agencies, because the government are going to be really hot that you've got all of their boxes ticked. Employee resource groups, such as the Black Googler Network, push diversity to help their in-group in hiring and promotion decisions. Diversity in theory and practice. In police academies around the country, new recruits are taught to apply an escalation of force algorithm with non-compliant subjects. Ask, tell, make. The idea behind Ask Tell Make is to apply the least amount of force necessary to achieve the desired level of compliance. This is the means by which police power, which is ultimately backed by significant coercive force, can maintain an appearance of voluntary compliance and soft-handedness. Similarly, the power centers inside US institutions apply a variant of ask, tell, make to achieve diversity in their respective organizations. So when the policeman asks you to do something, or you know, pulls you over for a ticket or something mild, he has a power which is a force which he doesn't have to use. He doesn't have to pull a gun on you to say, let's see your driver's license, or you know, your dog just pooped on the pavement. You know it's wrong, and there's a policeman there, and you want to sort of just walk away, but there's a policeman around, so you'll make the effort of it. Or these small minor things. The policeman doesn't have to pull a gun on you to say, well, you know, you've got to be a decent person in all of this. So it's this kind of force which is there, which can be applied if it has to be, but because of the promise of it, because of the potential of it, it doesn't actually have to be deployed. So this is what he's saying about the diversity hiring as well, is that like people understand where power lies. Power doesn't have to be completely overt. It doesn't have to be sticking a gun in your face. It doesn't have to be slapping lawsuits and suing your company and taking you to court and all of this kind of thing, because you know where power lies. You know that it could do that if it wanted to, and so you'll get ahead of the curve and comply beforehand. The first tactics for implementing diversity imperatives are the ask tactics. These simply ask all members of the organization to end bias. So it's very mild, you know, nobody wants to be biased. At this stage, but the problem is the outcome is determined. You know what they want in the end. At this stage, the policies seem to so reasonable and fair that there will rarely be much pushback. Best practices such as slating guidelines are a common tool at this stage. Slating guidelines require that every hiring process must include a certain number and type of diverse candidates for every job opening. Structured interviews are another best practice that requires interviewers to stick with a script to minimize the chance of uncovering commonalities between the interviewer and the interviewee that might introduce bias. Often HR will become involved in the hiring process, specifically asking the hiring manager to defend their choice not to hire a diverse candidate, because the wrong answer could result in shaming, loss of advancement opportunities, or even termination. The hiring manager can often be persuaded to prioritize diversity over competence. Again, within specialized professional service companies, senior level recruiting will occasionally result in a resume collection where not a single diverse candidate meets the minimum specifications of the job. This is a terrible outcome for the hiring manager, as it attracts negative attention from HR. At this point, firms will often retain an executive search agency that focuses on exclusively diverse candidates. When that does not result in sufficient diversity, roles will often have their requirements diluted to increase the pool of diverse candidates. You've got all of this just seems madness, that all of these bureaucracies and all of these managerial systems are so terrified of meeting the diverse quotas, which have shown no tangible benefits to their companies whatsoever, whether in terms of turning just basic profit. It's a capitalist system, we used to think so, where everybody was out to make a profit. It doesn't help with that, and it doesn't help with the actual running of the company or the business, the bureaucracy, whatever it is, because it's everywhere. For example, within hedge funds, the ideal entry-level candidate might be an experienced former investment banker who went to a top MBA program. This preferred pedigree sets a minimum bar for both competence and work ethic. The first-pass filter enormously winnows the field of underrepresented candidates. To relax requirements for diversity's sake, this will be diluted in various ways. First, the work experience might be stripped. So in order to shovel the diversity in, they're not asked to do any kind of work experience. Next, the role gets offered to MBA interns. Finally, fresh undergraduates are hired into the analyst role. Dilution works not just because of the larger field of candidates it allows for, but also because the Harvard Admission Office of 2019 is even more focused on certain kinds of diversity than the Harvard Admission Office of 20. It's just increasing all of the time. This dilution is not costless. Fewer data points result in a wider range of outcomes and increase the risk of a bad hire. All bad hires are costly, but bad hires that are diverse are even worse. The risk of a wrongful termination lawsuit either draws out the termination process for diverse hires or results in the firm adjusting by giving them harmless, busy work until they leave of their own volition. Either way, a terrible outcome for the organizations which hired them. So the on the one hand, they're terrified not to hire them, and then when they do hire them, they can't get rid of them. And they just got to sit back and wait for them to go away of their own accord, or give them like a harmless non-job somewhere where they can't do a, you know, they can't wreck anything. And it's, you just think like, how is this like, what how is this in the how is this in the interests of either turning a profit or running any kind of complex system? The combination of a pyramid-shaped org chart and a senior leadership team where white men often make up 80% or more of the team means that the imposition of an aggressive KPI sends a message to the layer below them. No white man in middle management will likely ever see a promotion as long as they remain in the organization. This is never expressed verbally. Rather, those overlooked figure it out as they are passed over continually for less competent but more diverse colleagues. The result is demoralization, disengagement, and over time, departure. So, I mean, we've already seen this in some of the armed forces, but eventually, it is. It isn't just that. It isn't just that straight white men are not being hired. It's that even when they are actually in the job, they know themselves that they're never going to get a promotion, they're never going to get ahead because of all of this law and all of this legislation, which ensures that they will always be passed over by the diversity. So, as he says, demoralization, disengagement, over time departure. So then this compounds the problem because the social capital is now going to head off and do their own thing. And this is actually, well, maybe one of the reasons why there's been this massive dropout of people engaged in the workforce for the last few years in Britain, which really kicked in after the pandemic, but we're seeing it more, this big thing. And I think this is part of it, because at the end of the day, this just sounds, it sounds like a horror show to be in one of these things. I mean, I've always been very low down in warehouses and whatnot. And it's not as bad. I can imagine when you get into office work, you get into this kind of bureaucratic work. I can imagine it being much, much worse. Like if you worked in a bank or something like that. The latest technique, which was recently brought to light, shows UC admissions officers using the applicants' high schools as a proxy for race to achieve their desired goal. Heavily Asian high schools, such as Arcadia, which is 68% Asian, saw their UC San Diego acceptance rate cut from 37% to 13%, while 99% Hispanic Garfield High School saw its UC San Diego acceptance rate rise from 29% to 65%. The preference for diversity at the college faculty level is similarly strong. Jessica Nordell's End of Bias, the beginning, heralded MIT's efforts to increase the gender diversity of its engineering department. When applications came in, the Dean of Engineering personally reviewed every one from a woman. If departments turned down a good candidate, they had to explain why. I'm going to skip ahead because it is quite a lengthy article. I would say definitely read it all yourself. And he's coming on with, he's obviously, you've got to get some pushback. So how did that go? As such, when explicit exclusion is used to eliminate groups like white men from selection processes, because that's what's happening. The selection process is just basically weeding, win, as he put it, winnowing out white men. You just won't get there anymore. Managers are told to sequester all the resumes from non-diverse candidates, that is, white males. These resumes are discarded, and the candidates are sent emails politely telling them that other candidates were better fit, while some so-called reverse discrimination lawsuits have been filed. Most of these policies go unreported. The reasons are straightforward. Even in 2023, screening out all white men is not de jure legal. Moreover, so it isn't actually legal yet to just outright discriminate against white men, but it's coming very, very close. And as we saw before with the policeman with his gun, he doesn't always have to draw it. It's implied and it's understood. You know, it's understood where power is. So as he says, moreover, any member of the professional managerial class who witnesses and reports discrimination against white men will never work in their field again. So if you want to go in to bat for white men, wrongful discrimination or something, reverse discrimination, that's a risky game to play because it's not going to do your career any favors whatsoever. I mean, this is the exact opposite of white privilege. It's the complete inversion of the world that white privilege theory describes. Even anonymous whistleblowing is likely to be rare. To imagine why, suppose incontrovertible evidence was produced that one's employer was explicitly excluding white male candidates and a lawsuit was filed, the employer's reputation and the reputation of all employees there, including the white men still working there, would be tarnished. That said, we can expect to see more lawsuits from men who feel they have little to lose. Yeah. Competency is declining from the core outwards. So now we're going to get to the nitty-gritty of it all. Think of the American system as a series of concentric rings with the government at the center. Directly surrounding that are the organizations that receive government funds, then the nonprofits that influence and are subject to policy, and finally, business at the periphery. Since the era of the Manhattan Project and the space race, the state capacity of the federal government has been declining almost monotonically. It's worth pointing out here that he is his take on the system here is that it all emanates from law. Law first, and then the rest trickles down. It isn't that all of these corporations just think it's trendy to be woke so much. Obviously, there's a bit of it, as we've seen. But he is saying, at the end of the day, if you want to look at where power lies in his framing here, it is the government itself. It's rather than, it's certainly not some sort of grassroots thing, which is coming up by popular consent of all these lefties on social media. Forget it. It's also not really that all of these corporations are doing it in the interest of capital. It's that the government has written in laws and policies which are going to be eventually backed up by force. And so in his framing here, it's the government, it's law and policy and legislation coming from the government, which is the problem. The state capacity of the federal government has been declining almost monotonically. While this has occurred for a multitude of reasons, the steel girdle, this is a very nice turn of phrase that he does here. While this has occurred for multiple reasons, the steel girder supporting the competency of the federal government were the first to be exposed to the salt water of the Civil Rights Act. So the Civil Rights Act is just something which is rotting all of the infrastructure of the United States, like rust, salt water on steel. It's very nice. And related executive orders. Government agencies, which are in charge of overseeing all the other systems, have seen the quality of their human capital. I mean, look, I understand what it's a nice way he's putting it there. Okay, it makes it hopefully safe for YouTube. The quality of their human capital declined tremendously since the 1960s. Well, the damage to an age, and to be fair, he is talking about meritocracy here. While the damage to an agency like the Department of Agriculture may have long-term deadly consequences, the most immediate danger is at safety-critical agencies like the Federal Aviation Administration. All right, so now we're heading to the sort of the problem. It's all very well. It's all this diverse hiring. It's dead. It's the white men are increasingly facing dead end careers where they get passed over. Where we now know that a bureaucracy will be scared of being caught out, not being diverse enough. Eventually, law will follow, even if that doesn't go there. So, all right, fair enough. We've touched on all of that. Where does this take us? What happens to the system itself? What are the actual outcomes here, rather than left-wing fantasy and whimsy? So he says that the air traffic control ATC system used in the US relies on an intricate dance of visual or radar observations, transponders, and radio communication, all with the incredible challenge of keeping thousands of simultaneously moving planes from ever crashing into each other. Since air control is one of the only jobs that pays more than $100,000 per year and does not require a college diploma, it has been a popular career choice for individuals without a degree, who nonetheless have an exceptionally good memory, attention span, visual spatial awareness, logical skills, so on. The air traffic selection and training exam, a standardized test of those critical skills, has historically the primary barrier was historically the primary barrier to entry for air controllers. As a consequence of the ATSAT, as well as a preference for veterans with former air control experience, 83% of air controllers in the US were white men as of 2014. Here we go. That year, oh God, that year, the FAA added a biographical questionnaire to the screening process to tilt the applicant pool toward diverse candidates. Facing pushback in the courts from well-qualified candidates who were screened out, the FAA quietly backed away from the BQ and adopted a new exam, the Air Traffic Skills Assessment. While the Air Traffic ATSA includes some questions similar to those of the BQ, it restores the test's focus on core air traffic skills. The importance of highly skilled air controllers was made clear in the most deadly air disaster in history, 1977 Tenerife incident. Two planes, one taking off and one taxiing, collided on the runway due to confusion between the captain. 583 people killed, and resulting in sweeping changes to aviation safety culture. Recently, the tremendous US record for air safety established since the 1970s has been fraying at the edges. The first 3 months of 2023 saw nine near-miss incidents at US airports, one with two planes coming within 100 feet of colliding. This terrifying uptick from years prior resulted in the FAA convening safety summits in March and May, respectively. Whether they dared to discuss root causes seems unlikely. I mean, yeah, so if yeah, what more is there to say? The aeroplanes are going to start and fall out the sky, folks. Given the sheer size of the US military in both manpower and budget dollars, it would not come as a surprise that the diversity push has also affected the readiness of this institution. Following three completely avoidable collisions of US Navy ships in 2017 and a fire in 2020 that resulted in the scuttling of USS Bonhomme Richard, a $700 million amphibious assault craft, two retired Marines conducted off-the-record interviews with 77 current and retired Navy officers. One recurring theme was the prioritization of diversity training over ship handling and warfighting preparedness. Many of them openly admit that, given current issues, the US would likely lose an open naval engagement with China. Instead of taking the criticism to heart, the Navy commissioned Task Force One Navy, which recommended de-emphasizing or eliminating meritocratic tests like the officer aptitude rating to boost diversity. Absent an existential challenge, US military preparedness is likely to continue to degrade. The decline in the capacity for government contractors is likewise obvious. with the largest contractors being the most directly impacted. The five largest contractors, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon Company, and Northrop Grumman, will all struggle to maintain competency in recent years. I mean, he goes on quite a bit here. Meanwhile, on the defensive side of the business, Boeing's new fuel tanker, Pegasus, is years behind on deliveries due to serious technical flaws with the fueling system, along with multiple cases of foreign object debris left inside the plane during construction. Tools, a red plastic cap, and in one case, even trash. Between the issues at ATC and Boeing, damage to the US's phenomenal aviation safety record seems almost inevitable. After government contractors, the next most affected class of institutions are non-profit organizations. I mean, I would say they're also largely responsible as well, by the way, but that's all a big sort of tangled web. But the lifeblood of non-profits is access to capital, either directly in the form of government grants, there we go, through donations that are deemed tax deductible. Accessing federal monies means being subject to the full weight of US diversity rules and regulations. Non-profits are generally governed by boards whose members tend to overlap with the list of major donors. Because advocacy for diversity and board memberships are both high status positions, unsurprisingly, board members tend to voice favorable opinions of diversity, and those opinions flow downstream of the organizations they oversee. I'll go on a little bit more there. This is where we're going to get the real meat of it. Like I say, I really just wanted to recommend this fascinating article here, because the general impression that you get, like I mentioned earlier, is that yeah, America might be invulnerable to being blockaded or starved out or even financially hit, and it's certainly not going to be invaded. But America is collapsing itself from inside like this, and it's tragic. I'm not going to gloat about it, I think it's bad, but I also I don't see how they can get out of it without the system just going mental. What they can do is sort of bring in other diversity, which is a bit more competent, I guess, from somewhere else. Promoting diversity over competency does not simply affect new hires and promotion decisions. It also affects the people already working inside of America's systems. Morale and competency inside US organizations are declining. Those who understand that the new system makes it hard or impossible for them to advance or are demoralized, affecting their performance. Even individuals poised to benefit from diversity preferences notice that better people are being passed over and the average quality of their team is declining. High performers want to be on a high-performing team. When the priorities of their organization shift away from performance, high performers respond negatively. This effect was likely seen in a recent paper by McDonald, Keeves, and Westphal. The paper points out that white male senior leaders reduce their engagement following the appointment of a minority CEO. While it is possible that author, oh, I don't know what that is correct, that white men have, I mean, looking at that name, I bet this is some kind of, sort of social justice shite. And that white men have so much unconscious bias, yeah, there we go, raging inside them, that the appointment of a diverse CEO sends them into a tailspin of resentment. There is another more. So, I mean, it's unbelievable because, on the one hand, you've got somebody, presumably diverse, a diverse hire, then gets a leg up in the publishing industry. The publishing industry ticks a box so that a diverse hire publishes a book. The book is anti-white. The book then focuses on the fact that the same thing has happened in some other, say, a bank, where white men are getting pissed off because the same process has meant that they now have diverse bosses and they're checking out of the system. And then the person, the diversity hire who wrote the book, is now going to write a book about that they've got this bias raging inside of them that the appointment of a diverse CEO. It's just horrible. It's just like this Kafka-esque trap that which is. It's disgusting. It's like this labyrinth, which denies its own oppressive nature. When boards choose diverse CEOs to make a political statement, high performers who see an organization shifting away from valuing honest performance respond by disengaging. Some demoralized employees, like James Damore in his now famous essay, Google's Ideological Echo Chamber. I mean, that was an earlier story on all of this. He was a sort of canary in the coal mine. Will directly push back against pro-diversity arguments. Like James, they will be fired. Older, demoralized workers, especially those who are mere years from retirement, are unlikely to point out the decline in competency and risk it cost them their jobs. Those who have a large enough nest egg may simply retire. Everybody just wants to get out of Dodge. But I mean, it's what younger fellas are going to do. I mean, this is just, again, this is just focusing on the human capital and not infrastructure. As older men with tacit knowledge either retire or pushed out, the burden of maintaining America's complex system will fall on the young, lower performing young men angry at the toxic mix of affirmative action hurting their chances of admission to a good school, and credentialism limiting the good jobs to graduates of good schools are turning their backs on college and white collar work altogether. And why not go off and be a plumber, be an electrician, something like that? Just get away from this sort of corporate managerial system. That's the way to go. Like, become a landscape gardener or something like that. This is the continuation of a trend that began over a decade ago. High performing young men will either collaborate, coast, or downshift by leaving high status employment altogether. Collaborators will embrace allyship to attempt to bolster their chances of getting promoted. Coasters realize that they need to work just slightly harder than the worst individual on their team. The shirking is likely to go unnoticed, and yeah, so it's basically they're completely demoralized. This system is completely demoralizing the best, as his words, YouTube, the best social capital. You see, of course, YouTube is, you've got to walk on eggshells on YouTube as well. It's relentless. The combination of new employees hired for diversity, not competence, and the declining engagement of a highly competent sets the stage for failures of increasing frequency and magnitude. The modern US is a system of systems interacting together in intricate ways. All these complex systems are simply assumed to work. In February of 2021, cold weather in Texas caused shutdowns at unwinterized natural gas power plants. The failure rippled through the systems with interlocking dependencies. As a result, 246 people died. In straightforward work, declining competency means that things happen more slowly and products are lower quality or more expensive. In complex systems, declining competency results in catastrophic failures. He's really heading into his final flourish here, which is great. To understand why, one must understand the concept of a normal accident. In 1984, Charles Perrow, a Yale sociologist, published the book Normal Accidents: Living with High-Risk Technologies. In this book, Perrow lays out the theory of normal accidents. When you have systems that are both complex and tightly coupled, catastrophic failures are unavoidable and cannot simply be designed out. Around. In this context, a complex system is one that has many components that all need to interact in a specified way to produce the desired outcome. Complex systems often have relationships that are nonlinear and contain feedback loops. Tightly coupled systems are those whose components need to move together precisely or in a precise sequence. The 1979 Three Mile Island accident was used as a case study. A relatively minor blockage of water filter led to a cascading series of malfunctions that culminated in a partial meltdown, similar to Chernobyl, where Chernobyl went up. In A Demon of Our Own Design, author Richard Buchstaber added two key contributions to Perrow's theory. First, that it applies to financial markets, and second, that regulation intended to fix the problem may make it worse. The biggest shortcoming of the theory is that it takes competency as a given. Oh, now this is a big one. He's heading for the home run here. the systems that we live with in the West, again, to use his terminology, they were built by a certain set of competency. Must be the you that's like the new euphemism. So now they're replacing these most complex systems ever created with people who are diverse and rather than being competent. Because the two don't go together. If you're gonna force by law to hire certain people, then it means people who are actually qualified to do the job, they're not gonna get there. And part of this, which I think is where he's going here, is this sort of taking the system for granted and assuming, well, there's this kind of, this is why in the Substack article on this, I called it Too Heavy for Superman, because there's this assumption that the system will keep taking over, that there's a kind of omnipotent force or power which can help us out and which will stop the planes falling from the sky or stop the power station from breaking down and everybody freezing in their homes and all of this kind of thing. The answer is clear. Catastrophic normal accidents will happen with increasing regularity, while each failure is officially seen as a separate issue to be fixed with small patches. The reality is that the whole system is seeing failures at an accelerating rate, which will lead in turn to the failure of other systems. In the case of the campfire that killed 85 people, PG&E fired its CEO, filed Chapter 11, and restructured. The system's response has been to turn off the electricity and raise wildfire insurance premiums. This has resulted in very little reflection. The more recent coronavirus pandemic was another teachable moment. What started just 3 years ago with a novel respiratory virus has caused a financial crisis, a bubble soaring inflation, and now a banking crisis in rapid succession. So one system failing has consequences for another. I mean, I would say in all of this, the first system that failed is allowing left wingers into positions of power to write law. That's where this is going to take you. That happened all decades and decades ago. It's a bit too, a bit too late now. Americans, this is great. Americans living today are the inheritors of systems that created the highest standard of living in human history. Rather than protecting the competency that made those systems possible, you can't, because it's far right. It is far right to promote competency. The modern preference for diversity has attenuated meritocratic evolution at all levels of American society. Given the damage already done to competence and morale, combined with the natural exodus of baby boomers with decades worth of tacit knowledge, the biggest challenge of the coming decades might simply be maintaining the systems we have today. The challenge of the future will be to maintain the status quo in the face of doing away with the best social capital, essentially. The highest social capital is being passed over in favor of diversity. And this is boring. Boring things are going to happen. It's kind of boring that the health and safety or quality control in, say, a food processing plant will decline. But this is kind of what he touched on a little bit earlier. But you wouldn't actually, it'll be very difficult to pinpoint this because it's systemic. It'll be everywhere and nowhere at the same time. It's just this sort of, everything's just going to be gradually turning to shit. The path of least resistance will be the devolution of complex systems and the reduction in the quality of life that entails. For the typical resident in a second-tier city in Mexico, Brazil, or South Africa, power outages are not uncommon. Tap water is probably not safe to drink, and hospital-associated infections are common and often fatal. Absent a step change in the quality of American governance and a renewed culture of excellence, they prefigure the country's future. So basically, it is, depending on how you want to look at it, the diversity hiring practices are much farther than this is like a bit of woke bullshit in the office or whatever. It is eventually, it's if it's happening everywhere in areas where you need a higher social capital and it's not there anymore. Think of the nuclear power plants. So I just thought this was a fascinating article and a real wake-up call. And it also, because of the systemic nature of this, it also kind of prefigures a civilizational spanning threat. I know I've said it before, but it is worse than it's just all this woke crap. It's going to have real tangible effects on infrastructure. And in his argument here, he says it already has. It already has done that. So anyway, I just thought that was great. I thought I'd go through that with you folks. Take care out there. Watch for wheels coming off cars and collapsing bridges. I'll catch you later, folks.